Welcome to the July 1990 edition of the Freeman on Tape. The Freeman on Tape is the audio cassette edition of the Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington-on-Hudson, New York, 10533. This edition of the Freeman on Tape contains, on side one, The Military's Secret War Against Racism, by Lee Nichols. The Right Kind of Social Activism, by Edward Walter. Employee Ownership, a Rapidly Growing Threat to a Free Market, by Dwight D. Murphy. And Perspectives. On side two, Book Review, The Diary of H.L. Mencken. And a Fee Classic, The Moral Foundation of Freedom, by Ralph Husted. The Military's Secret War Against Racism, by Lee Nichols. Reader's note. Mr. Nichols is a retired Voice of America broadcaster. The following is an account, condensed from the author's unpublished memoirs, of how he broke through the armed forces' curtain of silence on its racial integration drive in the late 1940s and early 1950s. I was working as a rewrite man on the United Press night desk in Washington, D.C. in 1952. When I got wind that something was going on about the military establishment's racially segregated forces. I thought that there was racial progress in the U.S. in general that had not been fully reported and that might make a magazine article. The head of Collier's Magazine's Washington Bureau expressed interest in the military aspect of that picture and asked me to submit an outline of an article. At that point, I didn't have enough information to write even an outline, let alone an article. But I was encouraged to begin digging by James C. Evans, the civilian assistant for racial affairs to the Secretary of Defense. Evans, a black man, was deeply involved in what was taking place within the military in regard to race, but his mouth was sealed. All he could do was give me a wink and a nod to goad me into searching. With the assistance of the Army's Chief of Public Relations, who apparently thought the story had to come out sooner or later, and that I seemed to be a responsible reporter, I began seeking information at the Pentagon, but I was getting nowhere fast. Finally, a major in the Army Personnel Division suggested that I visit the Army's training base at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. He refused to tell me why I should visit Fort Jackson or what I would find there. My interest was piqued. Having nothing to lose, I took a week off from my job and drove to Fort Jackson on the outskirts of Columbia, the South Carolina capital. I was welcomed by the public affairs officer at the base, who had been notified of my coming, and immediately learned that Fort Jackson had been racially integrated for the past 2 years. Few people today can realize what that piece of information meant to me at that time, in the summer of 1952. As far as the public knew, the Army and Navy and Air Force was still racially segregated as it had been for over a century. No hints of any moves toward ending this segregation had filtered into the public's awareness. Yet here, adjacent to a major southern city, in full view of anybody who looked, was a fully integrated training base, functioning efficiently without fuss or fanfare. At Fort Jackson, I learned how this racial integration had come about. The base had been beefed up as a major infantry training center shortly before America's entry into the Korean War, and had received a substantial influx of black soldiers. It would have required two complete training organizations to handle what would have amounted to two separate army groups. The commander of Fort Jackson, Brigadier General Frank McConnell, told me he had requested permission to put the black and white soldiers together. His request was bucked up to a certain level from whence the word came saying, in effect, "Don't ask." McConnell took this to mean, "Go ahead, but don't say anything." McConnell, realizing the possibility of a public outcry if his move made headlines in the local press, told me he had met with the editors of Columbia's two daily newspapers. He explained what he planned to do and asked them, as a patriotic service, not to publicize the action unless they were forced to. The editors agreed. Their newspapers maintained silence. Fort Jackson was integrated quietly, smoothly, with a minimum of trouble. I was told this and saw with my own eyes the black and white soldiers eating, sleeping, and training side by side. There had been and were continuing problems with on-base social clubs and off-base activities, problems that reflected long-standing social mores and that continued for years after basic integration had occurred. From Fort Jackson, I drove to Fort Bragg in North Carolina, another Army training base where I found much the same racially integrated situation, the same at the Marine Corps Training School at Quantico, Virginia, and to my growing excitement, a major degree of racial integration in the Navy. The latter was pointed out to me at the huge Norfolk, Virginia naval base by a young southern-born white Navy public relations officer who was obviously proud of what the Navy was doing. Returning to Washington, I wrote an outline for an article and submitted it to Collier's Washington office. To the chagrin of the man who had encouraged me, Collier's New York headquarters turned down the proposed article. I succeeded in placing the article with the Freeman, April 6, 1953. It was later reprinted by Reader's Digest. Next came my book. Jim Evans at the Pentagon and Neil McNeil, a colleague at United Press, urged me to expand my article into a book. I felt overwhelmed at the prospect, unable to contemplate it. McNeil took me to visit his father, Neil McNeil, Sr., a retired editor of the New York Times, at their home in Southampton, Long Island. I told the father what I had discovered. The elder McNeil, a man of Scottish ancestry born in Nova Scotia, told me I must write a book about it. I owed it to the American people. He recalled to me his being in the South and seeing a group of black school children waiting for a bus to their all-black school, then watching a bus filled with white children passing swiftly by. With tears in his eyes, he told me this incident had filled him with shame for America. The story I had to tell would purge some of that shame. McNeil Sr. found me a literary agent who, after a couple of tries, persuaded Random House to publish my book, as yet unwritten. The agent sold it by virtue of an outline and three sample chapters. He also showed Random House a reprint of my Freeman article, which had been placed in the Congressional Record by Senator Hubert Humphrey. I shudder to remember what it cost me to write that book. Random House had given me a contract calling for a finished manuscript in slightly under 3 months. I hadn't finished my research and took time to visit Air Force bases in Illinois, Mississippi, and Texas. I visited the Pentagon several times to check facts, and I was working full-time on the UP night desk, so I had to write late at night into the early morning and on weekends at a frantic pace. I didn't make the deadline, but Random House scheduled the book for publication on February 15, 1954. It was entitled Breakthrough on the Color Front, a title I had put at the top of my paper when I started writing, assuming we would work out a more suitable name later. There was no later. When I finally raised the question, a senior editor at Random House looked surprised. "What's wrong with the title?" he asked. It stayed. The book didn't sell many copies, but it was a critical success. The New York Times gave the whole of page 3 of its Sunday book review section to a highly favorable review by the noted military historian, S.L.A. Marshall. The New York Herald Tribune carried an equally laudatory review by Roy Wilkins, then administrator and later head of the NAACP, the day before publication. It was widely reviewed by newspapers and magazines all over the country, South as well as North. Time magazine gave it a full page with pictures in its news pages. A friend in Time's Washington Bureau told me it had not been placed in the book review section because it was a major piece of news of which Time had been ignorant. Senator Humphrey gave Random House a quote for the cover saying, "The book recorded the first truly effective step that has been made in implementing the Emancipation Proclamation." Jim Evans at the Pentagon offered a comment for the cover that the book was a contribution to national defense through solidarity. Evans told me that the previous year, 1953, two justices of the Supreme Court had requested and received from him copies of the manuscript of the book, still incomplete, while the court was considering the school desegregation issue, Brown versus Board of Education. He told me one of the requesters was Chief Justice Vinson, who died before the court reached its verdict. He would not tell me the name of the other justice. I have no way of knowing whether the book had any influence on the court's May 1954 ruling that public school segregation was unconstitutional. I assume the court, in pondering the issue, was concerned, among other things, about the impact such a ruling might have on America's social structure. And my book recorded, in explicit detail, the lack of adverse effects resulting from the military's integration program. In 1955, the Supreme Court issued a second ruling implementing its 1954 decision. In its Friend of the Court brief to the High Court, the U.S. Department of Justice cited my book by name as evidence that public school desegregation would be acceptable to the American public. In gathering material for my book, I had found that the military establishment had wrapped a tight curtain of secrecy around its program of racial integration. Why was such a bold human rights initiative hidden from public view? The reasoning was explained to me by officials involved and confirmed by key Southern members of Congress. If the integration program had become known while it was in progress, Southerners in Congress would have been virtually forced to publicly denounce it, which could have had a devastating effect on the whole effort. On the other hand, the military, to a general, defended the integration program in secret meetings with key congressmen as being done solely on the basis of military efficiency. There was little doubt that this was the case. History had shown that all black troops, on the whole, with notable exceptions, had been unreliable, largely due to the existence of segregation, which made them, and made them feel like, second-class citizens, usually relegated to labor tasks and jobs as Navy stewards, under the often prejudiced command of white officers. Although military efficiency was given as the official reason for the military's push to integration, as I dug deeper, I found more profound motives among many officers and civilian defense officials. Probably the first move toward racial integration in the Navy was sparked during World War II by a young Navy lieutenant, Christopher Smith Sargent, son of an Episcopal minister assigned to Navy headquarters in Washington. Sargent prodded the Navy into setting up its first wholly integrated seagoing vessels in this century, a destroyer escort and a submarine chaser. The year before this historic step successfully took place, young Sargent delivered a sermon at All Souls Memorial Church in Washington, in which he said, "Few can be heroes doing deeds of great import. Each Christian act we do, each high-minded thought we go by, will add a bit to the Christian way." Presiding over the Air Force's racial integration program were two men, the nation's first Air Force secretary, Stuart Symington, son of an Amherst College professor, who grew up in a home free from racial bias where help for blacks was stressed, and Symington's personnel chief, Lieutenant General Idwal S. Edwards, son of a Baptist minister and born in a town called Freedom, New York. President Truman's executive order of 1948, calling for equality of treatment and opportunity in the armed forces, played a major role in pushing to completion the already begun integration effort. It was well known that Truman took the Bible and the Constitution literally in his belief in the equality of races. In the summer of 1953, when I was working on my book, I asked him in a personal interview what he thought of the successful military integration. Truman replied, "It's the greatest thing that ever happened to America." The Right Kind of Social Activism by Edward Walter. Professor Walter teaches in the Department of Philosophy, University of Missouri, Kansas City. Today's gravest social problems, the use of hallucinogenic drugs and the dissolution of minority communities, feed upon each other. Blacks and Hispanics form a major part of an economic and educational underclass that, being isolated from mainstream society, doesn't share mainstream values and goals. Drug use becomes an expression of alienated minorities, and drug abuse leads to violent crime. Education, if it is no more than a publicity campaign, won't cure the drug problem. Unfortunately, the American public education system has failed blacks and Hispanics. The politicizing of public education, which is a natural outcome of federal funding, is a primary cause of the system's failure. Educational policy is molded to achieve politically inspired social goals rather than to impart knowledge and skills. Now, however, a new program called Project Choice, started by Marion Laboratories, now Marion Merrill Dow Incorporated in Kansas City, shows great promise for raising the educational performance of minorities. Project Choice inculcates productive values, teaches intellectual and vocational skills to those who usually are bypassed by the educational system, and doesn't expand the governmental bureaucracy. It can add skilled workers to the labor force while reducing drug abuse and crime. Project Choice was begun in 1988 by Ewing M. Kaufman, founder of Marion Laboratories and principal owner of the Kansas City Royals baseball team. The program aims to improve inner city communities by elevating the values of their youths and preparing young people to take their place in the business community. Goals that have eluded public education thus far. Project Choice employs principles that Kaufman used to build Marion Laboratories into one of America's most successful pharmaceutical companies. Kaufman's life exemplifies the best American business tradition, a modern Horatio Alger story. He began his business career as a salesman for a pharmaceutical company in the 1940s. Within 2 years, he was so successful that his commissions totaled more than the salary of the company's president. In retaliation, his commissions were cut and his territory was reduced, so Kaufman left to start his own business. With $4,000, he set up shop in his basement. In the first year of business, his one-man operation netted $36,000 in gross sales and a $1,000 profit. With Kaufman as chairman, Marion Laboratories grew to over 3,000 employees with $752 million in gross sales and a net profit of $150 million in 1988. A year later, Dow Chemical Company bought Marion. Today, Kaufman is a billionaire. In the autumn of his career, Kaufman, through Project Choice, seeks to revive personal initiative and hard work as educational values. Project Choice targets inner-city youths who are mostly black and Hispanic. Students who participate in the program are selected solely on the basis of financial need. Contracts are drawn between the selected students and the Ewing M. Kaufman Foundation, requiring students to attend classes regularly, participate in specially devised educational assistance programs, and to avoid alcohol, drugs, and parenthood. Students also must agree to submit to random drug testing. Parents co-sign the agreements. The foundation grants scholarships to colleges, universities, or technical schools to students who satisfy the prescribed conditions and graduate from high school. Tuition, fees, the cost of books and supplies, and reasonable room and board expenses are paid by the foundation. Students are expected to attend schools in their resident states, but may choose schools outside the region with the foundation's approval. Kaufman is eager to have students select technical schools as well as colleges and universities. He hopes to develop data processors, secretaries, and other skilled workers to shore up a workforce that hasn't met the demands of an increasingly innovative technology. The program was launched in April 1988 with a group of eighth graders. This year, approximately 700 secondary school pupils in Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, took part in the program. Students are encouraged to participate in tutorial programs developed at area colleges. These programs seek to improve mathematical and reading skills in a student body that, prior to entering the program, had high absentee records and low test scores. To facilitate the change in student attitudes, parents are encouraged to attend monthly meetings where student progress and problems are discussed. Thus far, the student participants' progress has been very encouraging. In the first two random drug tests, students tested 98% drug-free, which is far below what is usually found in inner-city schools. Surprisingly, students who weren't tested complained about not being given a chance to prove they were fulfilling their contractual obligations. Project Choice students have the best attendance records at targeted schools. Students who previously failed coursework are making significantly better grades. A strong sign that student attitudes are improving is that a number of eighth grade contractors attended summer school to raise their grades so that they would qualify for entry into high school. Project Choice is a long-range investment in business and society. It and similar programs should serve as models for inner-city communities. Employee Ownership Threatens the Free Market by Dwight D. Murphy. Dwight D. Murphy is a lawyer and a professor at Wichita State University. In the first 9 months of 1989, 80 of the Fortune 500 companies established employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs, involving shares worth $15 billion. This accelerated one of the fastest structural changes that has ever occurred in the U.S. economy. Employee ownership is rapidly becoming a leading economic and political force. 16 major pieces of federal legislation since 1974 have created tax breaks and other preferential treatment for employee ownership. State legislatures have joined in by creating other preferences and tax incentives. The rush toward employee ownership is part of a worldwide phenomenon. The world left pushes it as part of its renewed interest in workers' control as the centerpiece of democratic socialism. Employee ownership is important to socialist policies both in Western Europe and in the countries emerging from Soviet domination. At the same time, ironically, many leaders of American conservatism have spoken up for employee ownership. Unaware of the dangers, they see it as a way to involve employees in capitalism and also to privatize governmentally owned enterprises both inside and outside the United States. The left has renewed its interest in earlier decentralized models of socialism, the inspiration for which came from the French socialist Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, 1809 to 1865, who advocated organizing the economy around mutualist associations funded by low-interest government loans, social credit. Early in the 20th century, British guild socialists called for the organization of industries into guilds. These, in turn, would form a confederation of industries. It was guild socialism that inspired the great industrial democracy vogue among American liberals between 1910 and the mid-1920s. Since World War II, there has been a major socialist literature, both in Western Europe and the United States, making workers' control a principal element. A 1984 book by Christopher Gunn, for example, spoke of workers' self-management as a way of linking ideological, grassroots, and spontaneous resistance to capitalism. The theoretical model of a free market doesn't bar firms because they are owned and run by the same people. But the compatibility assumes that the worker-owned firms will have come about through market choices and freedom of contract, not through massive state intervention. It also presupposes that worker-owned firms won't harbor an anti-capitalist ideological solidarity that will turn them into vehicles for socialism or for ever-increasing government intervention. Is there, however, any reasonable expectation that employee ownership will really serve free market purposes? The answer, unfortunately, is no. Workers' control isn't a feasible transition to a market economy in Eastern Europe or the Third World. Given the predominance of the left in much of the world, workers' control will take its place as a form of democratic socialism. Although better than totalitarian socialism, this will enmesh the peoples of those countries in yet another round of the economic wastefulness and inefficiency that typifies every form of socialism. In the United States, it is unlikely that the rush into employee ownership will lead to socialism. Nevertheless, it is predictable that the left will work hard to mold employee ownership into an ideological constituency. Even without ideological content, ESOPs are quickly creating one of the largest U.S. special interest groups. When tens of millions of people come to be encompassed within employee ownership, the movement will possess vast political power. Will any employee-owned firm then be allowed to fail, after its employees have counted on its resources for their financial security? And when tens of thousands of firms are protected from failure, we will hardly recognize our system as a competitive market. So far, employee ownership has been universally welcomed. The time has come to give it a serious second thought. Perspective. Sweatshops by William R. Allen from The Midnight Economist. Journalists and political sorts deem sweatshops to be evil, and evil is to be directly eradicated. We are to pass strict laws, strictly enforced, to abolish low pay, long hours, unpleasant working conditions, unpleasant working hours, including work at home, and use of children. But is that really the end of the story, the end of analysis of the problem, the end of policy prescription? We simply outlaw the scourge of sweatshops and walk away in prim satisfaction? What is to happen to the erstwhile workers, commonly uneducated, poorly trained, illegally in a land foreign to them, with little experience and marketplace sophistication, who have had their livelihoods abolished? They had been surviving, even if meanly by civilized standards, in market competition by selling their limited services of low value at meager wages. Taking away those miserable jobs, pricing them out of what had been their best option, does not magically provide them with better alternative employment. Reducing their already poor power to compete, leaving them more handicapped than before, is a strange way to help them. Sticky Fingers by Eugene L. Gotz, Arlington, Massachusetts. During my lifetime, I can recall endless examples of sticky fingers in the public till, and I can also recall the endless legislation, myriad investigating committees, and cries of the outraged public. But when all is said and done, we still have government scandals. We will never completely erase public greed and corruption. We are imperfect creatures at best. But there is a way to give the citizen better odds. Drastically reduce the size of government. Wipe out big chunks of entrenched bureaucracies. We can't eliminate sticky fingers, but we can reduce the size of the cookie jar. End of side one. To continue, please turn the cassette over. Side 2, The Freeman on Tape, July 1990 edition. Book Review, The Diary of H.L. Mencken, edited by Charles A. Fetcher, Alfred A. Knopf, 1989, 476 pages, $30 cloth. Reviewed by David M. Brown. David M. Brown is the managing editor of the Laissez-Faire Books Catalog and a freelance writer. H.L. Mencken was an American phenomenon. His was a gaudy and gorgeous career, propelled by a divine afflatus. Born Henry Louis Mencken in 1880, he began his literary life as a workaday journalist in turn-of-the-century Baltimore. In 1914, having conquered the world of newspapers, he joined theater critic and fellow bourgeoisie slayer George Jean Nathan as co-editor of The Smart Set. From this makeshift perch, Mencken alternately terrorized and bemused the culture as the most daring social critic of his time. He was to reach the zenith of his influence in the 1920s as editor of the American Mercury. In addition to being a prolific essayist, reporter, and book reviewer, he found the time to publish books on literary and political matters, and in his later years became known as a formidable scholar of the American language, a field of study he pioneered. He also prepared two bulky, as yet unavailable, accounts of his experiences in the newspaper and magazine business, and wrote a 2,100-page diary, a third of which has now been selected for public consumption. And all this without a word processor. Mencken, ever the beleaguered champion of civilization, fending off the invading hordes, was an arch enemy of all things banal, mediocre, and hypocritical. His forte was a devastating, albeit usually venomless, satirical wit that blended a stupefying erudition with a kind of disingenuous barnyard raillery. The style that was the product of these attributes was and remains utterly unique. Mencken's work is fundamentally preoccupied with the promotion of positive values rather than with the demolition of bad ones. He was a tireless defender of men of ability and originality, as well as of the individualist creed and political freedom that made the achievements of such men possible. He was, as Murray Rothbard calls him, the joyous libertarian, and in his total independence and indifference to opposition, the spiritual archetype of the free man. With his myriad critical judgments, Mencken conveyed a fortitude that was tough and inspiring. But whatever his lambasting of morons and mountebanks in public, in his personal life he was not at all the ogre that his boisterous ferocity in print might suggest. Typically, he was genial, polite, and civil to a fault. This is no contradiction. As a polemicist, Mencken was brilliant and unsparing, but this needn't imply a zealot, bereft of courtesy, or blind to all perspectives save his own. There are plenty of examples of such dogmatism in any age, and they are always disheartening. Instead, what we have in Mencken's case is a man who saw with both eyes was ruthlessly honest about what he saw, but who could also be compassionate. In the often affecting entries of the diary of H. L. Mencken, we see a personal sympathy intermingled with an often harsh realism, but the judgments rarely seem unfair. This observation leads us, however, to the media hubbub that greeted the publication of this journal, which was sealed by Mencken's request from public view for 25 years after his death in 1956, and which for several years past has been available only to scholars and the rumor mill. No one who reads H. L. Mencken closely can doubt his individualism, his Jeffersonian belief in an aristocracy of talent, and his sweeping rejection of egalitarian and collectivist notions. Yet it is precisely Mencken's individualist social and political views which led to his popular downfall with the advent of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal, as social planning, along with its philosophical underpinnings, began to spread with an ever-increasing virulence. Today we are beset with an egalitarian ethos that often transmogrifies observation of plain facts into a mortal sin. This kind of blind egalitarianism seems to have infected much of the public reaction to the diary. At issue are Mencken's occasional dubious references to friends and acquaintances by their ethnic or religious background, which in the minds of many commentators demonstrate his racism. Throw in Mencken's antagonism to the welfare programs of the New Deal, his hostility to U.S. entry into World War II, and his failure to explicitly condemn Hitler as evil in the pages of this journal, and no further proof of his Nazi sympathizing is required. To his credit, the diary's editor, Charles Fetcher, does not himself jump to this last conclusion. He merely supplies the requisite premises and evaluations. But racism, if the concept has any meaning at all, does not mean mere reference to a person's race, even in an inappropriate context, but rather judging and treating an individual based on his race as opposed to the content of his character. Perhaps Mencken may be justly accused of a mild racial prejudice or stereotyping, but there is ample evidence even in this journal that he was hardly a racist per se in his attitudes and behavior. For example, his praise of black journalist George Schuyler, or his general support as editor and critic of the so-called Harlem Renaissance, documented by Charles Scruggs in The Sage in Harlem. As for the charge of anti-Semitism, Sheldon Richmond reminds us that Mencken expressed private concern for the situation of German Jews as early as 1922, and in early 1939 attacked U.S. policymakers for failing to admit German refugees into the country. The initiative should be taken by the political mountebanks who fill the air with hollow denunciations of Hitler and yet never lift a hand to help an actual Jew, he wrote in The Sun. Editor Fetcher and his uncritical media parrots, however, grab at a few offhand characterizations in Mencken's private journal in order to brand him as a bigot at the expense of the example of his whole life. Even the communist presidium of the Progressive Party's 1948 presidential convention, attended by all the worst idiots in the United States, refused to entertain a Maryland resolution denouncing me as anti-Semitic and anti-Negro, as Mencken ironically notes in his entry of July 26, 1948, one of the last. The Sage of Baltimore would no doubt have chuckled over the current uproar, given the serene amusement with which he tolerated even the most vituperative abuse in his own day, He even anthologized some of it just for fun in a little book called Mencheniana, a Schimpflexicon. In any case, the controversy cannot obscure the tremendous value of his journal, valuable especially for the light it sheds on how Mencken dealt with the adversity of his later years. Mencken began his diary in 1930 at the age of 50, and as his influence was beginning to wane. Discussed in it are his brief marriage with his beloved Sarah, her death from meningitis in 1935, the physical and sometimes mental decline of many of his friends and associates, his own ailments and physical deterioration, and the wartime censorship that prevented him from airing his political views in print. But despite many opportunities for bitterness, Mencken possessed a genuine equanimity and peace of mind that sustained him through the worst of times and the saddest memories. Writing a decade after Sarah's death, he notes that, "I shall not forget her. My days with her made a beautiful episode in my life, perhaps the only one that deserves to be called romantic. It seems to me to be vain and even a bit silly to resist the irremediable. But I think of her with tenderness and a kind of longing." There is a wistfulness here, but also acceptance and dignity. In other entries, Mencken weighs the good and the bad in his life and concludes that, despite his problems, the scale is tipped in his favor, with reasonable prospects for achievement in the years remaining to him. His public skepticism and cynicism notwithstanding, he was not only a realist, but an optimist as well. The diary's final entry is dated November 15, 1948, 8 days before the stroke that ended Mencken's productive career, though not his life. That end would not come until 7 weary years later. Mencken's legacy, of course, is timeless. A Fee Classic, The Moral Foundation of Freedom, by Ralph Husted. Every year, indeed every day, is an appropriate time to review the moral foundation of our republic. Such a review appeared in the March 1966 Freeman, prepared by Ralph W. Husted, an Indiana businessman and long a close friend of the Foundation for Economic Education. Here now, slightly condensed, is his testimony for your enjoyment and guidance. I never miss an opportunity when I am in Philadelphia to look at that small room where the architects of this nation, in a relatively short time, drafted, debated, and finally adopted the Constitution. The vision of a great republic was given to a handful of men who, when opportunity came, were prepared by education, courage, and faith to discharge one of the greatest responsibilities ever undertaken by men. I do not believe it was an accident that those men were brought together at the same time and at the same place in history. I think it was no accident that among that small group were some of the greatest thinkers of their day. To one who sees about him a world of infinite plan and design, things do not just happen. There were times, we are told, when the Constitutional Convention approached disruption. I believe the fact that it was finally successful was not an accident. I believe the courage and wisdom demonstrated on that occasion were not accidental. And I believe it was no accident that Madison was able to draft in a short time a document containing the wisdom of ages, and at which men have marveled ever since. The man who sees history as a great laboratory in which it has been proved time and again that cause has its inevitable effect, according to the design of a power greater than any of us can envision, cannot believe that the birth, education, and experience of Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson, and Madison were mere accidents of history, and that the founding of America was merely a fortunate coincidence of men and circumstances. Our founding fathers believed that we live in an ordered universe. They believed themselves to be a part of the universal order of things. Stated another way, they believed in God. They believed that every man must find his own place in a world where a place has been made for him. They sought independence for their nation, but more importantly, they sought freedom for individuals. Freedom for men as individuals to think and act for themselves. There, in Philadelphia, they established a republic dedicated to one purpose above all others, the preservation of individual liberty, the protection of a society where men would be free to pursue their purposes in life as they see them. They did not think man's purpose in life is to be determined by government, or that government has any business deciding what purposes our society shall serve. When we speak of individual liberty, just what do we mean? In the final analysis, I think it has three essential elements, namely, freedom of worship, economic freedom, and political freedom. Freedom of worship meant to our forefathers exactly what the words imply, that is, freedom to worship as one pleases. But remember, it also meant to them the right not to worship at all. We know, of course, that very few of them were disposed to make that choice. For most of them, worshipping God was an essential part of their lives. It is true that they believed in and advocated the separation of church and state, but they certainly did not believe in separation of the people from God. There is an additional point I want to make in connection with religious freedom, and it leads to the central idea of what I have to say here. Religious freedom means nothing without economic and political freedom. Life is not divided into neat little compartments, one of which can be considered without regard to all others. Life can't be divided, nor can freedom. It is impossible to have religious freedom without political and economic freedom. It is equally impossible to have economic or political freedom without religious freedom. Now let us consider economic freedom in that light. Economic freedom means literally freedom to seek the means of satisfying one's material needs. But I doubt that any man ever considered his own well-being in terms of material needs alone. Consideration of man's material needs necessarily involves thinking at the same time about his spiritual needs, because his well-being depends upon satisfaction of both, and both, consciously or unconsciously, influence his efforts to satisfy his wants. Hence the interdependence of economic and religious freedom. The significance of economic freedom lies in the very nature of creation. We are made one at a time, and no two of us alike. The differences between us are great, and by far the greatest differences are spiritual. The bare necessities of life are few, but the number of material things necessary to give expression to the spirit of mankind is endless. The millions of forms in which property is molded by the hand of man and the millions of uses to which it is put are but extensions of the millions of human personalities who gather property and adapt it to their needs, whether it be a pencil or a steel mill. Property is but a reflection of the infinite spirit of man. It reflects the desire of the human spirit for self-expression. If you agree with this, I think you will also agree that property, to serve its purpose best, must be private property. By the very nature of creation, no two of us can have the same desires, the same skills, or the same mental endowments. No two of us can express ourselves in the same way. Property cannot possibly serve the same purpose for one owner as it serves for others. What we call ownership is the right to the use, possession, control, and disposition of property. It is these incidents of ownership that make property useful in satisfying the needs of individuals. Complex as our system may be, it is nevertheless built upon something that all of us understand: the promise of one man to another. It is built on the right to contract freely, without the intervention of government. It is built on freedom of individual choice. A planned society may enforce specialization of work, but compulsion has never performed the miracles of production that have become commonplace among men who are able to contract as they wish. Now, what about political freedom? Political freedom, in the minds of many people, is something which they define vaguely by the word democracy, and which they associate with freedom of speech and the right to vote. To think of political freedom only as democracy is dangerous indeed, because a democracy can become a tyrannical mob. To think of political freedom only as freedom of speech and the right to vote is to fall into a socialist trap, because even the socialists profess to believe in both. The right to vote may be essential to freedom, but we should remember that time and again, people have given away their freedom by majority vote. Then what do we mean by political freedom? I think it is this: every right which we insist upon as free men carries with it the duty not to interfere forcibly with the enjoyment of the same right by others. Man's desire for self-expression is natural and good, and the right to self-expression is essential. But unless it is accompanied by a proper sense of responsibility, it may manifest itself in the use of force. We are responsible beings, but we all know that in the present state of civilization, and as it probably will be for ages to come, no one is or will be perfect. No one has or will have a perfect sense of right and wrong. We must, therefore, have the rule of law to restrain the use of force. But let us also keep this in mind: the law is not self-executing. The law itself must employ force, or the threat of force, to restrain those who would act irresponsibly. It may seem trite to repeat here that government governs best which governs least, but it needs to be said now as much as when first spoken. Political freedom means freedom from government restraint or compulsion, beyond what is needed to curb irresponsible men. When government goes further than that, it becomes the oppressor of freedom. When we turn over to government the job of planning, managing, or controlling any undertaking, regardless of how humanitarian it may appear to be, we must weigh the cost in loss of freedom. Because loss of freedom inevitably accompanies the delegation of such power. Today we are faced with the most serious attack on our freedom that has ever confronted us. I say the most serious because it is an attack on the very moral foundation which I have just described. It is little comfort to know that the attack may have been inspired initially by people beyond our borders. The disturbing fact is that the burden of the attack is now being carried by persons in all walks of life who profess to be and think they are good Americans. I think it has not been a case of knowingly abandoning our faith, but rather we have been led without thinking to accept many beliefs which in fact deny that men have a personal relationship with God. Individual liberty has been sacrificed, and government has come to be looked upon primarily as an instrument for social and economic planning. We have allowed to infect our political philosophy the belief that men are no longer able to take care of themselves. We have established an enormous bureaucracy to plan for them. We still profess the need for religious freedom, but we have repudiated the conviction of our forefathers that unless we also have economic and political freedom, religious freedom is meaningless. We have, for example, adopted a graduated income tax for the avowed purpose of supporting essential government functions, but we have changed our concept of what is essential, and we are now using the tax in shocking measure for the redistribution of wealth and as a means of controlling the lives of people. We have subsidies for housing, subsidies for farmers, subsidies for power, subsidies for shipping, and subsidies for the aged. We take one man's property to give to another and think it is right, simply because it is accomplished by majority vote. We have adopted the Marxist principle of from each according to ability, to each according to need. We have outright government ownership of hundreds of enterprises. We have government interference with the right to contract in practically every area of economic activity. In many areas, such interference is so great that the free market, freedom of economic choice, is gone. We have allowed ourselves to think that a little socialism will not hurt us, but the acorn has now grown into a giant of the forest. We have done all of this by majority vote, and in the name of democracy. Now, I do not want to be misunderstood. The word democracy still has meaning to me, and I believe in it. But I would ask you to remember always that democracy is not an end in itself. Despite the preaching of our present-day textbook writers and government social planners, democracy is not the goal of America. Democracy can be, and has been many times, an instrument for the abuse of individuals. Our goal is and must continue to be individual freedom. Today, many people, both in government and out, believe that the welfare of the majority is the criterion by which we should measure the extent of government interference in and control of economic affairs. We find people both in government and out urging an expanded program of government planning and spending in order, as they say, to improve society and strengthen freedom. We find today wholehearted endorsement of the idea that men are entitled as a matter of right to favorable working conditions, just pay, social security, adequate housing, and an adequate standard of living. Of course, these things are desirable. But let me remind you that in the America conceived by our founding fathers, man's inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the right to own property, are not granted by the state. They are God-given. A decent house, adequate pay, and Social Security are not God-given. God gives men the capacity to acquire these things for themselves, but no more. If we believe, as our founding fathers did, that we must let man be free to develop his sense of responsibility in his own way, and we must have faith that he will. When we come to understand that all men are endowed with the divine spirit, I think then, and only then, will we understand why men were meant to be free. End of The Moral Foundation of Freedom by Ralph Husted. We hope you have enjoyed the July 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. To subscribe to The Freeman on Tape, write to the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. Or call area code 914-591-7230. There is always a well-known solution to every human problem. Neat, plausible, and wrong. H.L. Mencken. Thank you.